Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern. Ich begrüße Sie aus Shanghai zu einer weiteren Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt. Hochinteressant, was wir hier erleben dürfen. China, für mich eine neue Welt, eine neue Galaxie in vielerlei Hinsicht. Man hat sehr, sehr viele Impressionen, sehr viele Eindrücke, die da auf einen einprasseln. Wenn ich jetzt zum Fenster hinausblicke, ich versuche das Ihnen kurz hier zu zeigen, dann blicken wir auf eine gewaltige, auch architektonische Kulisse. Ich weiß nicht, ob Sie das so verfolgen können. Wir sind mitten im Quartier Pudong. Das ist ein sich enorm dynamisch entwickelt habendes Quartier mit einer ursprünglich sehr uralten Bausubstanz, aber jetzt ist das Ganze also wirklich im Hightech-Modus, im Shanghai-Modus gewissermaßen in die Postmoderne katapultiert worden. Wir haben hier, oder wir sind unterwegs mit einer Gruppe von Parlamentariern, von Politikern, auch Geschäftsleuten, die zuerst in Peking, jetzt in Shanghai Gespräche führen mit hochrangigen Exponenten Chinas und uns. Ich bin ein journalistischer Beobachter, ebenfalls an Bord. Wir haben die Gelegenheit, uns hier eben einen vertiefteren Einblick zu verschaffen in die heutigen Realitäten von China. Sehr interessant, und über einiges, was wir da erlebt haben, sprechen wir nun mit dem heutigen Gast, und ich werde jetzt dann auf Englisch wechseln, obwohl seine Muttersprache auch nicht Englisch ist, aber auf Englisch können wir uns sehr gut verständigen. I just explained that I now will switch to English, that we can communicate, unfortunately not in your native language, from Slovenia, which I cannot speak, from Slovenian. Es ist Miroslav Gregoric. Miroslav Gregoric is a Member of Parliament. He's a engineer. He's a nuclear engineer by your profession. You correct me if I'm wrong. And Miroslav told me that he has entered politics at the very late stage, or at the relatively late stage in his life. He's not a professional politician, a lifelong politician. But, you know, after retirement, after having a successful career in engineering, he somehow felt the call of duty to go into politics. Probably he will tell us something about it. Miroslav, Mr. Gregoric, it's great to have you here in our program. Yeah, my question, what urged you, now being of rather experienced age, but still very fresh and lively and vital. What urged you to go into politics? What was your motivation?
Okay, just first I would like to make a short explanation. I'm originally a mechanical engineer, a master of science in heat and mass transfer, and from that angle I was in nuclear for thermohydraulics and so on, and I was head of the Slovenian regulatory body for nuclear safety, and I cooperated with Swiss nuclear body very much. Now, to your question, what brought me to the politics? Well, basically two issues. The decisive was a call from a friend who was assisting in forming a new party in Slovenia, a new movement. He was from next to be come Svoboda, and he asked me, look, we need some help. Would you come and join us before the election? So I said, okay. And the second, and then I was elected in Ljubljana. And the second motive was that I was really not happy with the state of democracy and political play, and rough political play before, and I wanted to join the movement that promised changes.
Mm-hmm. And Svoboda, if you would describe your party, what is Svoboda? Is it the party from the right? Is it from the left? Is it considered populist or whatever they call it these days? How would you describe
it? Well, it's definitely not populist. It's definitely not right. But to say that it's very left, no. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of realistic. Name is freedom, and we want to have more freedom for the people, more freedom for the enterprises, you know, more freedom in society, and less oppression. And we want, of course, to have rule of law, mm-hmm. and that everybody respects rule of law. Not mm-hmm. We don't want to have a Wild West.
Yeah. And what brought you to China? How did you come to join this group?
Okay, that's another story. Well, in the parliament, I'm pretty sure like in your, we have groups of friendship. And so I happened to be chairperson of a group with friendship with China. Similar, I'm chairing the group of friendship with Algeria and South Africa and so on. But so in this capacity, I was invited by through the embassy of China in Ljubljana to join these meetings that are ongoing here in China.
I mean, it's interesting. The European Union, the United States of America, they seem to weaponize, to militarize even their relationship towards China. We have a lot of coverage in the media saying China is on the totally wrong track. The Chinese are somehow even our enemies. They are an autocracy. We are the holy grail of democracy in Europe. So where does Slovenia stand in this very heated debate we have, a very one-sided debate, one could argue, about China in Europe?
Well, official Slovenia is 100% behind the European Union. Unanimous decisions, unanimous thinking, one voice. But I'm too old to follow this all the time. And I have seen too many things. By the way, I was 2002, 2003, I was 6 months in Iraq. Head of Iraq office of UNMOVIC, chasing the weapons of mass destruction of Saddam Hussein.
You were chasing those
we were chasing,
weapons of mass
we
destruction?
We were not successful. We couldn't find anything. And our reports of UNMOVIC and of IAEA were very critical, but still we couldn't find anything. And this was not enough. This was not good enough. We were there just to fill the gap to prepare for the war, which was written before. Mm-hmm. And I was naive and I didn't know. I didn't know.
So you were used, actually. Well, you were sent as yes. a smokescreen
yes,
to pretend we were.
After we left, after we evacuated, and we were not supposed to call this evacuation, but relocation, temporary relocation, I was really pissed of what happened. But the rest is history.
And this has somehow influenced your view on foreign policy. I mean, I interpret now your views, meaning that you are very skeptical when big countries are showing their muscles towards other countries.
Yeah, well, this was one lesson on geopolitics, and I follow the nuclear dossier of North Korea, of Iraq, and now, of course, of Iran. And you can see it's there are very major component is geopolitics. Mm-hmm. And for those that don't see, well, yeah. It's a problem.
And what do you say about the geopolitics of the European Union? Europe is, you can say, on the track of confrontation, of boycotting, not boycotting, but sanctioning China, other countries. Yeah, what's your comment on that? What's your take on European geopolitics?
European geopolitics is actually extended from geopolitics from Washington. We don't have our own opinion. We are not supposed to have our own opinion. whoever thinks with his own mind is already labeled. And not only against China, you see what kind of unanimous decisions are taken vis-a-vis conflict in Ukraine. Some were selling from the script. So many people have the same teleprompter. Mm-hmm. It was unprovoked war, mm-hmm. unprovoked. And of course it's unjust, but nobody sees the warnings mm-hmm. that were coming from American scholars mm-hmm. for the past 20 years. And in particular, Professor Mersheimer, what will happen? So,
who was in this program, by the way? I interviewed Professor Mersheimer also for good. Our
what
viewers.
What about Jeffrey Sachs?
Of course.
Yeah.
Several times.
But then you are already biased, the journalist, because you are off the official track.
Well, I'm a very old-fashioned journalist, and I think that the prime duty of a journalist is to question the dogma and the mainstream of his own community, and not...
And maybe also to put the questions from two different sides, or to listen to two different sides, but this is not allowed anymore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We are not supposed to look to watch RT.
Yeah.
You can get access to any porn on mm-hmm. the internet, mm-hmm. that's okay.
But Europe, it's forbidden.
But to get porn is not forbidden.
No, porn is not forbidden, but RT.
Yeah. RT is forbidden, so it's nonsense.
Yeah.
And now, so if you extrapolate this to China, I think we are, if we continue this way, it's a recipe for disaster.
Especially for Europe.
Yeah, well, of course, Europe will be collateral. Europe will continue to be collateral damage. Because 14 rounds of sanctions against Russia are working. But they are working against Europe. And I'm telling my colleagues in the parliament, if you, these sanctions are boomerang. And if you are throwing boomerang, you better be aborigine. Because then you know how to catch it. And we don't know how to catch it. And now what North Atlantic Treaty. Where is the word Pacific? And now Jens Stoltenberg was speaking about threats, about not challenging. Challenges is too mild. Mm-hmm. Threats from the China, threats to Taiwan.
But how do you explain this? As an experienced engineer, you know, you have seen the world. What is wrong with our political class? Now you see it from within. You have now with your own eyes, you see the politicians in Slovenia, you see it at the European EU level. What is wrong with the political class in Europe?
I'm too young in politics to be able to answer this, but what I see is that some politicians start with illusions. And basically, they repeat illusions one after another, you know. And so Ukraine must win. Ukraine will win.
Okay. Wishful thinking.
For me, it's wishful thinking is selling illusions to Ukrainians, because it's very difficult. This is not fight between Switzerland and Austria. Two non-nuclear powers.
We were superpowers 700 or 600 years ago, but...
That's different. No, but on one side we have a nuclear superpower, which you don't want to put into the corner because you don't know how it will react. And on the other hand, you have... So it's a problem. And I think that... It's a bad combination of NATO and European Commission leaders that were extremely hawkish.
Mm-hmm.
And what I don't like really is that they don't value or actually hate diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And now you have seen the, and to my understanding, mm-hmm. As you told me, you participated, or you followed the saga of Prime Minister of Hungary, Orban, who was trying to open the doors, to use the diplomacy to start the kind of negotiation process to stop the war. And he was, mildly said, mocked up, and he was almost became persona non grata in EU for the diplomatic efforts. Mm-hmm. This I found unacceptable. Mm-hmm.
Viktor Orban is a politician who is not on the same side as you. He's a politician of the right, of a liberal conservative. Some would say he's even, they call him also an autocrat and everything. Your party is more on the left center side. Yeah, what's your impression of Viktor Orban? Do you think his mission was successful? Do you think his mission was a good service to peace today?
I must make a clear distinction that what I speak is I'm speaking from my heart, from my head, and it's definitely not the position of my party.
Okay.
So I'm kind of, in this respect, I'm kind of dissident in my mm-hmm. party. Mm-hmm. I respect Orban. Of course, you can claim that some of his measures were anti-democratic or non-democratic. Okay, but at the same time, he had some measures that actually I like.
And, I mean, now this peace mission.
No, the peace mission was for me excellent.
Was excellent. And but, was it successful?
Well,
or was it,
this
what
we
do you
don't
say?
Know. This we don't know because I have no idea what he discussed with Zelensky, what he discussed with Putin, what he discussed in China. But I'm pretty sure that trying to find some common denominator mm-hmm. to move the negotiations further, that is definitely positive.
And what do you think about, just to wrap up the Ukraine issue, what do you think about this new initiative of President Zelensky, this offensive in the area of Kursk, the call for even longer range rockets he wants to apply? How do you see this strange escalation of the war onto Russian territory?
Well, I happened to be also in the Slovenia was part of ex-Yugoslavia, so I was a reserve officer in Yugoslav army, trained in Batajnica near Belgrade, for the officer for the anti-aircraft missiles, NEVA. At that time, the best what we have in Yugoslavia, this was 75, 76. So I have some, and then I was in the territorial army of Slovenia. I was commander of one division or whatever, for anti-aircraft guns that we were able to shoot down helicopters and transport mm-hmm. planes, but nothing. But was for to defend Ljubljana. So I have some military, few percent of military knowledge. And for me, the incursion into Kursk with the Ukrainian, it's nonsense. It's suicide missile because for several reasons. It maybe they want, I don't know what the final goal was, if it was just to embarrass Putin is one, if it was to attack Kursk nuclear power plant, that is very dangerous, and then maybe trap that for Zaporozhye nuclear power plant, but that's very dangerous and very tricky. How could they, but if they were thinking that, because this definitely motivates the whole Russian population, they don't like to be invaded. And so I think the effect will be definitely negative. They will, Russian people will stand even more behind Putin, and Putin will take time, and definitely they will throw the Ukrainian forces out. Mm-hmm. It's only a question how many will be thrown out alive and how many will be sent back in bags. So I think it was a suicidal mission, and they used the best units that they have, the best trained units to incursion. Mm-hmm. I don't understand the mm-hmm. military, mm-hmm. First Ukrainian officers who did it, and then all the NATO whisperers that were co-planning mm-hmm. this mission. I don't understand.
What do you think about the Russian president? He's depicted in our media as this devil in the Kremlin, as a man with it absolutely impossible to negotiate with. What's your opinion?
Well, he could be autocrat, but for a country that spans from Polish border to Vladivostok, and I don't know how many time zones,
11 or 12.
Yeah, you need to have maybe they lived under strong rule for centuries, and maybe they need some strong rule now. But taking this aside, I think he is rather rational, and he is quite capable. I don't see many Western leaders that could have press conferences of 4 or 5 hours and answer it without a paper. Mm-hmm. So he's quite knowledgeable about the affairs in Russia and affairs in geopolitics. And of course, he's aware of his might as a country. And he is confident because, like in China, he Soviet Union ended in disaster. And economical, they asked for help in economy from the West. It was rejected, and Jeffrey Sachs will tell you because he was there mm-hmm. firsthand. So they were very bad, and then he rised. And with the first sanctions, I think, first sanction packages that came after the Crimean invasion, Russia did not collapse, and Russian food industry survived, and now you can buy mm-hmm. cheese, Russian cheese or whatever. So they have enough of food, and the industry, it's not Chinese high-tech industry, but on the military side is sufficient, good enough to make big problems to the West and to the NATO.
Is Putin an enemy of the West? That's what they say.
Well, I think it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be because, I mean, now...
Are we turning him into...
Well, definitely. We are turning him into devil. I mean, criminal and devil and whatever. But I think I would not like to live in a world that we must choose only friends. I would like to have friends and neighbors and colleagues from different parts of the world, mm-hmm. and not to have friends and enemies. But now we must choose. You are my friend, and you are by definition my enemy. I don't accept that. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about China. You are here since, I would say, roughly a week. You have been to Beijing as well. I joined the group since Shanghai. What's your most striking observation? What is interesting about this trip? What have you learned?
I was in China 3 times. First in 1997 as a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency team to review the safety of Qinshan nuclear power plant. And then last year, October, November, 5 days, and we visited at that time Beijing, Chongqing, mm-hmm. a small city with 35 million inhabitants, and Shanghai. And now this is the second time. When I was living in October, November, I was frustrated. I was frustrated. Why? Because I realized how far the Chinese people, society, technology run away from us. They are very much ahead of us, but we don't want to understand this. We don't accept. So I hope more European politicians would visit China and see with their eyes. Mm-hmm. So I'm impressed what they did.
How would you describe this success model? of the Chinese.
Okay, very simplified, oversimplified answer would be, I'm pretty sure this would not be appreciated by many, in the West, with our blessed democracy, unique democracy, and we only respect our democracy, we spend, in many cases, 40% of energy in fighting between position and opposition, and blocking initiative from the opposition, from the position. Well, here is a bit simple. They have capitalism, but to a certain degree, and they have a much bigger component of programming, of planning, which is done by party, which we don't have, which we hate, which is our enemy.
But how do you, I mean, what can we learn as a society from this model? I mean, this is full of contradictions for a Swiss mind, for example. You have a one-party system on the one hand, but on the other hand, I mean, if you look around in Shanghai, this is not the planned economy style of Mao Zedong or of Leonid Brezhnev. I mean, this is a vibrating, you said it, it's a vibrating market economy. There must be a lot of room for entrepreneurial initiative. How do they bring this together, one-party dominance and this kind of anarchic market society with its dynamism?
They allow competition, they allow market competition, but I think they have some visions like how to build infrastructure, where to build infrastructure, how fast to build infrastructure, how to build cities that they have. And don't forget, they give a lot of money into I would call federal research. They give a lot of money in education. To my understanding, 14% of Chinese budget goes for education. They have the largest population of STEM students, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And this is driving the technological innovation. They put more than 3%, officially, more than 3% of GDP into research. Mm-hmm. Plus, the companies put money in research. And like maybe 4 years ago or 3 years ago, I did some small research on the Huawei 5G, because already 5G was non-democratic, you know, non-democratic 5G. And at that time, they had on the 5G Huawei company alone had 1,100 patents. The whole world together have 500 patents. Now they have 3,000 patents on 5G, and the rest of the world, I don't know, maybe 1,000. So they invest, and plus they have universities in every major city.
Yeah,
so
the Asian students are the best when they go to the American universities. They have the best GMAT scores and SAT scores, whatever you call them. And we have been today, we had a very busy program. We were participating, both of us. There were in the morning we had an encounter with representatives of the city government of Shanghai. This I found extremely interesting, how these gentlemen explained their political system to us. And they tried to show how keen the Chinese are, and especially the political authorities, to really find out, before they pass a law, what do the people think. And I mean, they showed us, they asked the public councils, they asked the citizens, they showed us a movie where you saw these party members interacting with citizens from Shanghai. What did you think when you watched these movies? Of course, they were a bit propagandistic, they were overly positive, and I think cynics in the West will say, yeah, that's typical Chinese propaganda, whatever. What did you think about this, these films, these explanations of their political system that they showed us today?
Well, I would agree that a few years ago this would be seen totally as a propaganda. But On the other hand, I can read it positively that they have found out that you cannot alienate the whole masses, and that it's very good to keep the population happy, that you find the mechanism that the people participate. Mm-hmm. So participate in one party system. That's maybe more even tricky, but yes, they showed us that they have different offices where people can show their question their parliamentarians on different levels, mm-hmm. parliamentarians, and that they collect the public opinion, which, and I think this is the move they are going.
And what I think what is totally underestimated in our media and in the Western coverage and also by some Western critics is the whole history of China. I mean, if you look at the history of China of the last 150 years, you see a country which was torn apart by colonial powers. Then the whole dynasty, this hundreds, thousands of year old dynasty fell apart. Then you had a civil war. You had a country on the verge of collapse. I think we totally underestimate that this huge country, China, there can come up in an instant forces that are not willing to cooperate with Beijing. I mean, we have heard today different cultures, different mentalities. I guess it's very difficult to hold this thing together, and therefore they have to invest more on political stability. Probably China cannot afford an antagonistic party system that we have in Switzerland, that you have in Slovenia. Probably it's just not working in such a country.
In such a huge country, maybe this would not work, but we see that their system is working, or at least technological progress.
And the people seem
to
be okay with it. There is no public unrest. There is no huge mass movement against the government.
Yeah, and I think they made a model which works in China. I'm not sure it could work in other places, but they are progressing beyond our, I would say, dreams or whatever.
Some observers in the West say that President Xi Jinping might overdo it. He has the reputation that after the years of Deng Xiaoping and the successors, that they opened up the economy, that now Xi Jinping is tightening the screws again. Do you see any symptoms that somehow the government is overdoing it with their grip on power at the moment?
I don't know, but I have another observation that China is getting every day more resilient, and the more pressure and sanctions the West put on China, the China comes out stronger. You know, China was rejected to be part of space program, US-Russia. They were rejected, but not probably by Russia. So they made their own. They have their own space station. They were blocked with the chips production, in particular Huawei. They made their own chips. Now, if they will be, in the meantime, they were the first. They jumped over the evolution of diesel engines and petrol engines for the car. They started 20 years ago with electric vehicles, and now they are the best. Mm-hmm. So I think that whatever sanctions the West, and in particular USA, will impose on China, China will be stronger.
It make them
and
stronger.
If now the with the new nuclear posture strategy or posture view of the US, when US is prepared to deter combined actions of Russia, Korea, and maybe North Korea, and maybe Iran, well, it will only drive China into building more nuclear weapons, which is absolutely unnecessary.
One huge topic during this trip was also the ecological development, the environment. Was climate change was a huge thing. I remember, like 20 years ago or 25 years ago, when there were the Olympic Games in Beijing.
It was smog. Yeah, it was smoke.
Yeah. Smoke was that. It was like one day in Beijing was like smoking 70 packs of cigarettes. Now you don't hear anything about smoke. And we have seen here in Shanghai, which was impressive for me. I thought first, Shanghai is like a, you know, a sterile kind of, you know, industrial skyscraper city. But it's actually extremely green. There are a lot of green spaces. What do you make of this whole ecological dimension of the Chinese model? Is it something that has impressed you too, or how do you assess it?
No, definitely. I can just confirm, and you have seen wherever we drove, either in Beijing or here, there is a lot of green, there is a lot of plants, of trees. They plant trees along the roads. They have many parks. But then there are some facts. At the moment, China is burning more than 4 billion, not million, billion tons of coal. And it's the number one coal consumption, consumer. But at the same time, China has the fastest growing hydropower, the fastest growing solar, and the fastest growing wind. Much faster than they planned. So hopefully the coal will soon not phase out, but level out. Mm-hmm. And that's one. And then we should not forget that China managed to provide food for themselves. So agriculture is stabilized, and they have in the green area, they are the number one in the world on successfully planting trees in the deserts, which is very important. So, and yesterday we saw, was it yesterday? Yeah, we saw this greenhouse.
And the bird camp, I think.
The bird reservation was excellent, but the greenhouse was also, because they use, they collect water, rainwater, and they increase during the winter when they use oil for heating or gas for heating, they increase the CO2 to have higher photosynthesis. It's fully automated. The technology original came from Holland, from Netherlands. They still have Netherlands expert there, but it looks very promising also.
Also an optimistic outlook there. Now you are a politician in Slovenia, you're a politician in an EU country. If you take all your impressions, all your observations from these travels to China together, and you say in your next speech in front of the EU parliament, if you had one, and you would say, okay, now what's the most important thing for the future for us in Europe? What would you tell the politicians in the European Union? What do you tell your voters in Slovenia after this trip? What is the most important thing you take out of this experience?
One of the things would be make more friends and no enemies. Then put much more money in research. Stop outsourcing labor outside. Europe must keep its own industry. We should be able to be much more self-reliant. Mm-hmm. You know, in Slovenia, and probably the same in Switzerland, our farmers provide food for 800 or 1,000 years without any or very little trade from outside. We were self-sufficient. Nowadays, we are not. Mm-hmm. And we are not self-sufficient in many things. So globalization had positive but also negative things, and I think we should balance this. Mm-hmm. But in particular, I would say make friends, no enemies.
And in one very final question, and in nuclear questions, in Switzerland, our government has decided that they should reverse their decision of going out of nuclear. So our government wants to take back Switzerland again into the nuclear future. We still have some running nuclear plants. We only mimicked a little bit the German position. We didn't do it in as thoroughly as the Germans. What's your take on nuclear energy? Is it a must for the future in Europe? Go back to nuclear?
It's definitely not a must. It could benefit in energy supply. But if we are realistic, in the past 20 years, the nuclear power in the world grew for 7 gigawatt or 7,000 megawatt mm-hmm. in 20 years. In the same time, solar grew mm-hmm. from 3 gigawatt to 1,600 gigawatt, and it's growing. So
the renewables, the so-called renewables, they definitely have a future.
Solar definitely has a future. But we need to have energy mm-hmm. storage, either batteries or pumping hydropower or hydrogen in the future and so on. So that's one. But the second one is, we are not speaking of a technical problem, but of a moral problem. How much burden are we going to give over mm-hmm. to grandchildren, of my grandchildren? Because not a single spent fuel element in Europe or in the US or in whatever was finally disposed of. And the first who might have final disposal are Finland, who will maybe do it this year or next year. Mm-hmm. So it's immoral mm-hmm. to leave the burden for the future generations. And the third comes out from the situation in Ukraine. Zero nuclear power plants are or can be designed against military attack. And we have seen.
So you have a ticking nuclear bomb in your
We have
garden.
Seen military attacks on Zaporozhye, and maybe there was one prevented in Kursk. So I know because I worked 6 years at the IEA on the area, not nuclear safety, but nuclear security. Mm-hmm. So design basis threat, which is the starting of mm-hmm. how you make your physical protection plan mm-hmm. for the nuclear power plant in Switzerland mm-hmm. definitely does not take into account military okay. attack.
Well, Miroslav, Mr. Gregorič, thank you very much for this wide-ranging conversation. Very interesting, and I would say as far as the nuclear waste is concerned, probably the Chinese will come up with a solution, because we are all deeply impressed by the progress China made. And I have had a similar feeling as you said at the beginning. I said, my goodness, we are sleepers. We are sleeping in Europe. Meine Damen und Herren, wir sind am Schlafen, wenn man sich vor Augen führt, mit was für einer Energie die Chinesen hier ihr Land entwickeln. Und bei uns hat man diese überheblichen Kommentare, die sich da immer wieder diese Schuhe abputzenden Kommentare an den Chinesen und dieser ganze politische Hochmut, der zelebriert wird. Ich glaube, das ist etwas vom Interessantesten, was man hier mitnimmt. I just was telling you, you understand. So, also, meine Damen und Herren, wir empfehlen Ihnen allen, einmal nach China zu fahren. Brechen Sie aus der Blase, brechen Sie aus der europäischen Medienblase und schauen Sie sich mal China an. Und überprüfen Sie die Vorurteile und Urteile, die Sie in den Zeitungen lesen können. Gehen Sie mal, wenn Sie Zeit haben, wenn Sie sich das leisten können, fliegen Sie einmal nach Shanghai, fliegen Sie nach Beijing und versuchen Sie, dieses Land einmal anzuschauen. Hochinteressant. Ich weiß, ich rede zu vielen, die das natürlich schon gemacht haben. Ich bin hier etwas noch der Nachholer. Ich bin der China-Laie. Aber ich kann Ihnen sagen, ich bin also mit großer beeindruckter Bewunderung werde ich dann die Rückreise in die Schweiz antreten. Noch einmal ganz herzlichen Dank an Herrn Gregorič. Auch interessant, was wir für faszinierende Politiker haben, auch in anderen Teilen Europas, in Slowenien zum Beispiel, einen Ingenieur, der sozusagen in der Spätblüte seines Lebens noch den Einstieg in die Politik findet. Großartig, auch das macht Hoffnung. Ich danke Ihnen ganz herzlich für die Aufmerksamkeit. Das war's fürs Erste. Wir melden uns selbstverständlich wieder zurück und mit weiteren Interviews, Gesprächen und Eindrücken einen schönen Tag.